This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaev, sitting in for Terry Gross. By anyone's standards, as editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar and the mother of two young adopted sons, Liz Tilbaris leads a full life. And that's not even considering the fact that she has cancer. Tilbaris started her career in fashion in the psychedelic 60s at British Vogue. During 22 years at that magazine, she rose to editor and then landed the assignment of editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar. In 1991, she moved her family to New York and completely reorganized Bazaar, which won two national magazine awards in her first year at the helm. Then Tilbaris was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. She believes her cancer was caused by extensive fertility treatments, which she underwent in her early 30s. Her new memoir, No Time to Die, describes her life in fashion and her experience dealing with her disease. I asked Liz Tilbaris when she first started feeling ill.
I had missed my yearly appointment, which was in the May of 93, and I was having quite a lot of symptoms. I was very depressed, which I never normally am. I felt very heavy, and I'd been feeling that way since the August. And it was now November, and I remember looking out of the house, out of the window on Thanksgiving Day, and thinking to myself, I'm really sick. I've got something wrong with me. I wonder if it's cancer. And the minute I got back to the city, I rang my gynecologist and said, I have to come in for an appointment. And it was then that she diagnosed it, and that was when everything started to happen so fast, because that was sort of the 1st or 2nd of December, and I was operated on by the 17th of December.
What made you think you had cancer?
I don't know. It was just a thought that passed by, and I think that that was the first time that I really knew that I had to listen to my own body, because it was something that came just into my head as I looked out of the window. It was nothing. You know, it was a very quiet moment. I was all alone. Everybody was out of the house, and it just suddenly came to me. It had nothing to do with anything. Nothing at all.
It all seemed to happen very fast for you. You went in for surgery within days. The surgeon immediately operated and removed as much cancer as was possible, and then your chemo started. Now, anyone undergoing chemotherapy worries about their hair and their appearance, I imagine, but your business is all about appearance. How much did you worry about how chemo would affect what you looked like and how your colleagues and your competitors in the fashion world would judge you? How you looked?
Well, it was very interesting because one of my very best friends is a wonderful, wonderful hairdresser, and he had already been cutting my hair for years. And when we talked about the fact that I had cancer and was about to have chemotherapy, which was really at Christmas time. I mean, I was operated just before Christmas. And he said, I think, because I had, a shoulder-length bob of kind of wonderfully white hair, and he, you know, to me, it was my trademark, it was my symbol. And he said, I think, you know, if you're going to lose it, I think you should cut it off, because you don't really want, you know, a whole kind of heap of hair on the pillow when you wake up, because it does fall out. The minute you have adrenomyosin, it falls out within 10 days of that. And so I agreed to let him cut it. And just before I cut it, we got hold via Sidney Lumet, the film director, a wonderful man who could make wigs. Because as you can imagine, I was really, I mean, vanity had taken over a little bit. I was quite worried as to how I would present myself in the marketplace, so to speak, with no hair. And he came on board. His name is Paul Huntley, and he's making wigs for everybody. And so he made this beautiful wig. So when my hair actually did fall out, I had what became known as Larry already sitting on my dressing table. And so I could feel the confidence of knowing that I could put this wig on when I was going to go out and back to work again. I think the other thing, I was discussing this with a friend of mine who just had breast cancer and lost all her hair. And I think that what happens, of course, is that you're so happy to be alive that in the end, although you've made all these preparations for your wig and for everything else that, you know, to make yourself look normal again, you're so happy to still be around your family and friends that it doesn't really, when it actually happens, it's not nearly as important as you think it's going to be prior to it happening.
Did you approach it, though, as a fashion editor? Here I go, I'm making my cancer makeover.
I didn't think of it like that, but I actually addressed it that way, yes. I mean, I didn't consciously think this was it, but I realized I had two very, very important events that I had to deal with. In fact, three, where I knew I would be, I had to, and one was I had to make a speech at the Waldorf, you know, to 4,000 people. Another one I had to give an award, rather, at the Council of Fashion Designers of America. And that was very daunting. And another one was we gave a dinner for Richard Avedon at the Whitney. And I knew I had to look like a real human being by that time. So, you know, that was when the resources that I do have, although not to do with my hair, I asked Ralph Lauren to make a dress for me, and I asked Calvin to make something for me for one of them. And, you know, that's when the fashion industry is incredible and really wonderful, and everybody pooled their resources, and I got clothes that actually fitted me, because I had lost at this point 30 pounds overnight, so to speak, when I'd had the operation. So I was much skinnier and nothing fitted. I mean, I had dresses to wear, but I couldn't, because I was a shell of my former self.
At one point, and this I didn't know about chemotherapy, you lose your facial hair also, your eyebrows,
your eyebrows and your eyelashes, and you develop this rather unattractive red rim around your eyes as well. The only thing you don't lose is your moustache, which is really depressing. So you keep the nastiest facial hair and lose the good bits, which is very sad. And nobody has to this day, although I've complained, pointed out as to why that doesn't happen. But anyway, so yes, I lost my eyebrows and I lost my eyelashes. And you don't really lose things like hair on your arms, for instance. Although you lose underarm hair to a certain extent, and you don't have to ever shave your legs. I mean, that's extraordinary. But your arms somehow don't get affected. It's very odd where the affectations take place. There's definitely a long book in that, I think.
You had a relapse in 1995 of cancer, and you underwent bone marrow transplant, which is, by all accounts, including your own, just an inhumanly grueling ordeal. But you directed staff meetings for Harper's Bazaar from your hospital bed in the isolation ward, and the staff had to wear masks and gowns.
Oh, it was terrible. But it was just a way of keeping going, I think. And I did make a lot of really bad decisions while I was lying in bed, high as a kite on morphine, because that was the only kind of drug that can take the pain away, because it's very, very painful.
Wasn't part of you during these meetings saying to yourself, oh, is this really the time to talk about hemlines?
But the funny thing is that that's all that really matters, because what's being done to you is being done. And so you want desperately to survive. And you want, I mean, I tried so hard to read books, but I couldn't concentrate. I tried so hard to watch television and I couldn't concentrate. And work was really the only thing where I could really fully grasp what was going on. And it was extraordinary. And everybody was very tolerant. I mean, my staff were magnificent, because I was not pretty. Because you can't swallow, you're dribbling all the time. And you have a little Hoover that sucks the saliva out of your mouth, and it's not a pretty color. It's not like regular saliva either. So these people were coming up and hearing me talk about cover lines and, you know, colors of the logo on the front of the magazine, and there I was hoovering away the saliva. It was just ghastly. I mean, they were very lovely, and I thank them all to this day for doing that.
How is your health now?
It's good. It's good. I mean, I still have a CA125 that blips. A normal person will have a CA125 of up to 35 points. When I was diagnosed in 1993, mine was well over 2,000, which means that there was a heavy dose of cancer circulating in my body. But with all the chemos that I've gone through, and only one lot of chemos really ever worked for me, so I've had a lot of chemo that I was resistant to, it's good. Meanwhile, they're trying to find chemos that when I really need to go back into having chemotherapy, which I probably will have to prophylactically, they're trying to find one that will actually work very well for me. And so that's our battle now, is to find one that I'm very sensitive to, that means that I will be able to reduce my CA125 to where it should be. It's not very elevated, but it does go up and down from time to time because they monitor it very closely.
My guest is Liz Tilberis. She worked her way up to editor-in-chief of British Vogue over 22 years at that magazine. In 1992, she took over as editor of Harper's Bazaar in New York. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer not long after that. She's written a memoir of her life in fashion magazines and her experiences dealing with cancer. It's called No Time to Die. We're going to take a break now, Liz, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harper's Bazaar editor Liz Tilberis. Her new memoir is No Time to Die. You write that British Vogue was the quasi-official documenter of the British royal family, and you, of course, featured Diana, Princess of Wales, many times in the magazine. How did you help to shape her image?
I didn't have anything to do with shaping her image in the early days. She first appeared on the Vogue scene about 1980 when she was engaged to be married. She was married in 1981. I started really working with her much later on, in about 1987, when I became the editor of British Vogue and realized that we had not taken any pictures of her for a while. And then the first time I really wanted to work with her, I persuaded her to wear jeans and a white shirt and be photographed with the boys at Highgrove. And although I didn't do the sitting, it was a sitting that I know she loved very, very much and treasured, you know, until she died. And it was really beautiful. And that was the very first time she sort of had been able to be casual in photographs. And we worked on from there with Patrick Marchelier taking the pictures. We just got a kind of wonderful rapport going, and every so 6 months or 9 months we'd have more pictures taken, and it was wonderful fun.
Did the royal family try in any way to pressure or censor your ideas about her informal image?
Not about the informal image, but when we tried to get her on the cover a couple of times, they felt it was inappropriate. There was one very beautiful cover when she was wearing a white chiffon Gina Frattini evening dress that actually appears on the back of the book that was written about her. And it was a really lovely cover, but the Buckingham Palace felt it was inappropriate because she was sitting on the floor. And then, of course, the very famous one, which has the tiara, and she is sitting on the floor with the taffeta embroidered dress, hugging her legs, was the one that we were not allowed to use on the cover. But the minute we were able to release it, or had to release it, because that was the way we dealt with Buckingham Palace, we released it about 2 months later, and it was on every cover in every magazine right across the world. And we were the only magazine that didn't have it on the cover, which was very sad.
You were hired away from British Vogue to Harper's Bazaar in New York. How does the American fashion scene differ from the British one? Is it a whole other world or aesthetic, or is the fashion world so international that you didn't really have to adapt to much?
The first point is, yes, you're absolutely right. The fashion world is very, very international, and I didn't have to adapt that much, I thought. But America has this incredible home market. The retailing system in America is so senior compared to Europe. And it was that that's always attracted me to America, because nowhere in the rest of the world can you go over 2,000 miles and find a similar store, whether it's Bloomingdale's, Neiman's, Saks, whoever. And it is incredibly good at supporting designers, in giving women in America what they want to wear. And I think that was one of the great, great benefits about coming here, is that fashion is taken very, very seriously. It's a very big industry. It's very, very important to the economics of the country. And in England, it's not. Although it's in the high street, it's not really at the senior level it is over here. Although you have stores like Debenhams and Marks and Spencers and things like that, they deal in budget clothes. And here in America, yes, we have great, great companies like The Gap and J. Crew and so on, that do have wonderful, wonderful clothes at a budget price. You also have these very, very senior retailing stores. And I find America an incredible place. If you're going to have a fashion magazine, this is the country to have it in.
One of the things you write that you most enjoy about your work is covering the big fashion shows, the Paris Couture. From what little I know of these events from the media, it looks like a circus. It looks like people are fighting to get in. Is the whole scene as brutal as it looks on the evening news?
Yes. In fact, once a long time ago, a security guard pushed a colleague of mine, and we were going up, you know, those entrances to cattle trucks? Well, this was entrance to a tent, but it was a cattle truck entrance. In other words, it had kind of grids going across it. And we were in our, you know, dressed in our nice clothes, because obviously we're supposed to be representing our magazines. And he pushed her, and I thought she was going to fall into a foot of mud, kind of puddle that was underneath the tent. And I was really angry, so I punched him in the face. And unfortunately for the guard, nobody saw me hit him. But when he hit me back, everybody saw, because we were on a sort of incline. And so this guy was almost, I mean, pulverized to death for beating up this fashion editor, which wasn't really his fault. So it does get pretty, pretty terrifying, I can tell you. And another time I was in Italy, and I said to the people I was with, we should leave this place immediately. I think this, I feel there's something really bad. And we left, and the tent collapsed. And, you know, a couple of people were really badly hurt. And so it does get very hairy. On the other hand, it can be beautifully organized, as Sail on 7th was this week. We had a wonderful time. The tents were beautifully organized. Even we had that terrible rainstorm in the middle of the week, and they had snow to put the tents up. Then they had a heat wave. Then they had the monsoon. And, you know, it can be a wonderful experience. I love going because I love sitting there and watching the clothes. That's my real joy. And it's taken me a long, long time to get to the front row, but I'm now in the front row. So I'm a lot safer than anybody else is.
How much does it cost for you at Bazaar to cover a show, say, in Paris?
Well, we cover the shows. We start in London, then we go to Milan, then we go to Paris. And it costs me well over $100,000 to send my crew there. And that what annoys me is that the length of time we're there is almost a waste of time because we have long gaps between the designers we really want to see. And I feel that the authorities in each country actually should be pulling the time down because eventually it's going to be too expensive for us to go at all. And that'll be a very sad moment because it's where we get our adrenaline fix for the next 6 months. So right now we're finishing June, but come July, the issue of July and August and September and October, we'll be using what we've just seen internationally for those issues.
Who wears the clothes? I understand that the clothes that you see in the fashion shows aren't for everyday wear. What is their point then?
Well, a lot of them are for everyday wear. The problem with the fashion shows is that there are now so many television cameras there that by the time that the television edits and airs 24 hours after the show, you eventually only see the really outlandish stuff. You know, if there's anything that the editors can, you know, the kind of the nudity that occurs on the show sometimes and the see-throughness obviously gets onto national television screens long before the good old camel coat gets there. So when we actually show pictures of the camel coat in August and September, ones that you and I'd like to wear and the raincoat and, you know, the nice pair of shoes, people are already terrified by the season because they've seen what the television companies have given them, with a few exceptions. But I go to the shows to look for the latest trends, yes. And those are what we publish in probably August and September. But we also give wide, wide range to, you know, the much more wearable sweaters and the skirts that just come to the knee and the very nice wrap-over coat. So there's a lot of clothes in all the magazines that you can actually wear if you really study it. Some of them are expensive, some of them are not. We try and balance the budget a bit for everybody.
You've been at this for, what, over 25 years, right?
Yeah.
You've seen every flip-flop then on fashion over that time. What keeps you interested in it?
I love clothes. I love fashion. I love the business. I have to say, it's the most amazing business. It's full of incredible characters, really, really professional people, and an enormous amount of kindness, an enormous amount of love and friendship. And, you know, now the designers that I grew up with, you know, are like Karl Lagerfeld and Calvin and, you know, they're friends. And so for me, it's the only home I know, and I love it. It's really a wonderful life.
I want to thank you very much for talking today, Liz Tilberis. It was enjoyable.
Thank you, Barbara.
Liz Tilberis' new memoir is No Time to Die.